If a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand them over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them. And then chapter 24, verse 7, so just on the following column. If someone is caught kidnapping a fellow Israelite and treating or selling them as a slave, the kidnapper must die. You must purge the evil from among you.
Have you seen the movie 12 Years a Slave? It won 3 Academy Awards. The leading actor there on your right got a BAFTA for his performance. It's based on a true story, the memoirs of someone called Solomon Northup, drugged, kidnapped, separated from wife and children, sold into slavery in the deep south of America, ended up working for an alcoholic, abusive man. It's a hard movie to watch because it shows very, very clearly what slavery was like at that time. Degrading, dehumanizing, oppressive, racist, and cruel. But one of the hard things that I found as I watched it was the way that the people who are carrying out the abuse in the movie justify it from the Bible. One reviewer puts it like this: they ruled with a whip in one hand and a Bible in the other. And that is the tragic, awful truth that many people who did terrible things during the slave trade, during those centuries really of slave trade, just try to justify it, at least from the Bible. No wonder that many people today in conversation with a Christian will tell you that they understand that the Bible is pro-slavery. Even people who you would think would be well-informed and who ought to know better will tell you that the Bible is pro-slavery. So, for example, Sam Harris, a philosopher, in a debate which took place on the Daily Wire, said these words: slavery is endorsed in the Bible. It is endorsed explicitly in the Old Testament and certainly not repudiated in the New. There's no place in the Bible where you can get a truly compelling case against slavery. Well, the other guests in the debate were very quick to gently and I think quite persuasively point out to him that that is really not the case and that he's quite misinformed about that. But people say it so often that we start to think it is true. And even Christians start to think that it is true, that maybe not the whole Bible, but maybe parts of the Bible are pro-slavery. We assume it must be right. And so then we say, okay, but that's just the kind of quirky bits, the weird bits, the old-fashioned bits in the Old Testament laws. But Jesus comes along, and Jesus is better because Jesus teaches us to love our neighbors, and his whole message is very different. The problem is when you look closely at the Bible, that really doesn't work. Because Jesus clearly backs the Old Testament law. He's fully behind it. He quotes from it. I don't know if Jesus had a favorite book. If he did, it was probably the book of Deuteronomy because he quotes from it more than any other. A place in the Bible that is full of these kinds of Old Testament laws that many people find upsetting. But Jesus loved that. He often would say things like, "It is written." As if to say, just the fact that it is there in the Old Testament law means that it is written. And many of the things that we most love about Jesus, actually, he didn't think up himself for the first time. He got them from the Old Testament law and from places like Deuteronomy. For example, love your neighbors as yourself comes from the Old Testament law. Now, as it happens, I've spent quite a bit of time looking at Deuteronomy for various reasons in the last few years. And so what I want to do is focus for the next 4 weeks on some of these kinds of passages from Deuteronomy that are so controversial. This talk is going to be on slavery. And the question that I want to answer is, isn't the Bible outdated and outrageous? All those bits of the Bible that people will quote to you and say, well, surely you can't be a Christian. Surely you can't, if you are a Christian, surely you have to dismiss large parts of the Bible because, after all, the Bible supports things like patriarchy or genocide or bigotry. And today, what I want to focus on is slavery, because the more I've studied books like Deuteronomy, the more I've come to realize that the truth about the Bible is very different from what we're often told. Let's have a look at it then together. So firstly, just a few points from Deuteronomy. The Bible liberates slaves. In the Old Testament law, slavery was limited to 6 years. After that, people had to be set free. Have a look back at the first reading Angie read for us. It was back on page 194, Deuteronomy 15. I'm going to start from verse 12 and look at some of the details of this law. Verse 12, chapter 15, verse 12, Deuteronomy, page 194. If any of your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you for 6 years, in the seventh year, you must let them go free. Now, the context of this chapter is about caring for the poor and needy, and particularly cancelling debts, because one of the ways that people could get in real financial trouble, and still do, is people could get in debt. And chapter 15, verse 1 says every 7 years you have to cancel all debts. Verse 11 says there will always be poor people in the land, therefore I command you to be open-handed towards the poor and needy. Well, those are words that Jesus himself quoted with approval in the New Testament. And so the practice of what's happening here, what's being described here with the word slavery, it is a lot more like bankruptcy than the kind of thing that was happening in 12 years as a slave. So you have to imagine someone can't pay their debts. It's about debts being cancelled. Someone can't pay their debts. And what are they going to do? Are they going to be left to simply starve and die? How can they find a way out of debt? So what they could do, just notice in verse 15, if any of your people sell themselves to you, so this is not about slaves being sold by someone else. This is the person themselves who is in so much debt that they can never pay it off, a bit like someone who's bankrupt, saying, well, I tell you what, I will work off the debt. I will sell myself to you. I'll give you my services. I'll work for you. I'll be your slave. I'll work away. And if after 6 years that hasn't been sufficient to pay off their debts, then the debt simply gets cancelled. The seventh year, reflecting the idea of the Sabbath rest in the Bible, you can't keep a slave for longer than 6 years. On the seventh year, they simply have to go free. Verse 13, and when you release them, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. Give to them as your God has blessed you. Now, this is a very strange way for people to be treated when they owe money. To be, you're working off your debts. And at the end of it, if the debt isn't paid, then you go free. Not only do you go free with the debt cancelled, you actually have to provide them with lots of things, get them back on their feet again, give them a share of all your meats and your crops and your everything you produce. Give them a start so they can have a fresh start and make a life again for themselves. Imagine credit card lenders doing that today. Imagine mortgage companies doing that today. It would make for quite a different society, wouldn't it, from the society that we live in. But there's a motive for that. Why is that? Why would they be supplying them liberally? Why would they be so helpful to those who are in debt? Well, because, verse 15, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you. That is why I give you this command today. This comes back to the central message, the message of the whole Bible, the central message of the Old Testament. These laws are not just laws given to the whole of humanity to say this is how you should live. What they are is there's a story of salvation going on here. God's people have been rescued by God. They know what it is like to be slaves. They were slaves in Egypt before, in their past, in their history. God has rescued them and set them free from that slavery and brought them, and they're about to enter this new land full of blessing that God is giving them. And God is saying, look, let that story change you. Let the fact that you have been set free from slavery and blessed by God and given an abundant life of freedom, let that change the way that you behave to one another. Care about those who are in desperate financial need. who were having to work off their debts, set them free for no good reason and give generously to help them get back on their feet. So it's that story of salvation. It's the same story that Christians have in the New Testament. We are set free from slavery to sin and death. It's what we all deserve. It's what controls and traps us all. But Jesus has died for us to adopt us into his family, to set us free from slavery and give us a whole new life. And the Bible is saying, let that change the way you treat one another. But exceptions to this could be allowed. This community that we're supposed to imagine in the Promised Land, that Moses is encouraging and promoting as they're about to enter that land, this community is the kind of place where actually a slave might not even want to leave their slave master and might actually prefer to stay. Verse 16, but if your servant says to you, I do not want to leave you, because he loves you and your family, they become part of the family. This is home. This is their community. This is their life. They would much rather this land of wealth and prosperity. And this is a great life. They don't want to be out on their own, again, struggling to make ends meet away from the people that they love. Supposing that happens, that's the kind of scenario we're imagining. If your servant says to you, I do not want to leave you because he loves you and your family and is well off with you, then take an awl and push it through his earlobe into the door, and he will become your servant for life. Do the same for your female servant. Give him an earring. We're not sure why they had to do it in this particular way. Maybe it's a way of making it known publicly so that your slave master can't just say, oh, I know I've had my slave for 14 years, but it was their choice. It's what they wanted. No, there's got to be a kind of public, visible announcement of that so that you know this really is the case, this really did happen, and they've still got the earring to say they're still happy with that. I don't know what would happen if the slave just decided to take out the earring and say, well, I'm not happy with this arrangement. Well, I think we'll find out, actually, in a moment, what would happen. So the story of salvation is that God pays the price for us through the death of Jesus to set us free from slavery. And that changes the way that we treat one another. And that was true even all those years ago in the very different society that they lived in then. So that's the first thing. The Bible liberates slaves. And then secondly, the Bible... having trouble getting this to connect. Well, there we go, back again. Protect slaves. The Bible protects slaves. So turn over a few more pages. Chapter 23, verses 15 and 16. That's on page 201 if you're in a church Bible. Page 201, chapter 23, halfway down the left-hand side. And verse 15. It says that if a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand them over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them. So what happens then if the slave does decide, say, for example, to take the earring out of their ear? What if they just decide they've had enough of being a slave? What if the way they're being treated by their slave master is not okay and they just decide to run away? Well, what happens is they have the right to do that. It says here, if they come to you for refuge, for safety, if they come to your town, your community, your village, your home, and they want shelter and they're being chased by some slave master who doesn't want to let them go, what do you need to do? Well, you mustn't hand them back. You mustn't give them back to their slave master. Instead of that, they have to be free to live among you, in your town, in your village, in your community, wherever they might choose to live. That is their right. And don't oppress them, don't treat them badly. Now, this is not normally what you think of when you hear the word slavery, is it? In the Deep South, in America, during the slave trade, if a slave tried to escape, you can see in museums some of the kind of metal collars that they would then have locked around them that they couldn't take off, so that anyone who saw them would know, well, this is one of those slaves that tries to escape, so we've got to really make sure that they don't get away again. And even in the ancient Near East, well, a writer called Christopher Wright comments on these verses. He says this: no other ancient Near Eastern law has been found that holds a master to account for the treatment of his own slaves. The universal law regarding runaway slaves was that they must be sent back with severe penalties for everyone who failed to comply. That's normal. That's what slavery was. But not in the people of God. Not in the promised land. What that means is that in all of the ancient world that you lived in, where slavery was just normal and acceptable, the way everybody did things, there was just one place you could run to where you would be safe. Only one. The law would protect you if you ran to Israel, to the people of God, and asked for safety. So it's a very different kind of slavery, slavery that people opt into and choose as a way of getting out of debt. A slavery that comes to an end after a limited period of time. A slavery in which some people just wanted to continue in because they were finding it helpful. Slavery that you could bring to an end when you wanted to, that you could leave and would have to be protected by the community. It's very different from what we imagine when we hear the word slavery. And it's very different from what happened centuries later and still happens in some parts of the world. People being kidnapped from families, beaten and in danger, working without pay, without hope. And the question, does the Bible condemn that, is answered very clearly in the next verse. Yes, the Bible does condemn slavery in that form. And you can see that in chapter 24, verse 7. Chapter 24, verse 7. If someone is caught kidnapping a fellow Israelite and treating them or selling them as a slave, the kidnapper must die. You must purge the evil from among you. Notice that key word, kidnapped. This is a different kind of slavery. This is a slavery where you've stolen someone and forced them into slavery. And notice that everybody here is guilty, not just the person who does the kidnapping, but also the person who sells the slave, or even someone who just treats them as a slave without making any money out of it. All of that is against the Old Testament law of Israel. And notice the very clear condemnation of this with that word, evil. That's how this kind of slavery is described in the Old Testament law. I wonder if anyone's ever pointed that out to you. Purge the evil from among you. That's what the Bible always said. Condemnation of slavery is as old as the Old Testament. Purge the evil from among you. And we have to get our heads around where this is in the Bible. So the Old Testament nation of Israel that Moses is describing, that is forming as he speaks, that is about to enter the promised land, is given to us in the Bible as a picture of the kingdom of God. It's not the real kingdom of God. In the Old Testament picture, they have a physical temple building, they sacrifice animals and shed blood. All of that is not the reality of the kingdom of God. All of that points towards the real true kingdom of God that is ruled by Jesus and that lasts forever. And so when it says here that the kidnapper must die, I mean, that's a much more severe penalty than is usually imposed in these situations. The kidnapper must die because evil has to be purged from among you. This is a picture of what God will do in the final kingdom of God. In the kingdom of God that we can be part of after we die forever, evil will be purged. There's only two ways that can happen. It'll either be those who do evil will die and not be part of that kingdom and never enter it. Or it will be because Jesus has died instead in our place, purging that evil from us so that we are welcome to be part of that kingdom. The Old Testament law is very harsh. Physical death for those who perpetrate this kind of slavery. The New Testament gospel is even more harsh, saying that the danger is eternal separation from God forever. Purge the evil from among you. So I think the first thing I'm trying to say is that the Old Testament law is much more negative about slavery than you might have heard and goes a long way to protect slaves. But it still leaves us with a big question, doesn't it? Because we might want to say, well, all this is very good. It's great. They've kind of limited the damage that slavery can cause. They've created a much more kind of a form of it that protects people much better. But why not just abolish slavery? Why didn't Moses just say, look, there will be no slaves? Why doesn't the Bible just come out and say, look, let's end slavery? And you could say the same thing about the Bible in almost every area. So, for example, when Jesus was asked some questions by the Pharisees. They were asking about divorce, and someone said to him, "Oh, a divorce must be, it's endorsed by the Bible. It's approved by the Bible, because Moses said you can have a certificate of divorce." Jesus said, "Yeah, but Moses only said that because your hearts were hard." The law takes into account, the Bible law takes into account, that we are living in a fallen, broken world. Do we want to be in a world where people, do we want divorce to happen? Do we want that to be the future? Will there be divorce in heaven? No, of course not. But it does happen. We live in a fallen, broken world. And so God speaks into it in a way that protects people and limits the harm it might cause, and does the same with slavery. The Old Testament world was a world where everything functioned on the basis of slavery. Let me give you another example. If you have a teenage daughter, let's make this hypothetical rather than talking about any particular teenage daughters. If you have a teenage daughter and they are invited to a party, say they're like 15, they're invited to a party, and you know the kind of party that you think it might be, what do you say as a father? Well, you could say, parties should be abolished. Well, at least that kind of party. I could say, I don't want to live in a world where it is normal for teenage boys to get drunk and try out drugs and try to couple up after the end of all of that in the dark with my daughters. That should be abolished. I actually think it probably should be abolished. I don't think it will happen in heaven. I don't think it's part of God's good design for relationships. But I don't live in that world. I live in the real world. I live in a world that is sinful and fallen and broken. So what I actually need to do as a father is say, well, look, okay, let's try and make this a bit safer. I'll tell you what, I'll come and pick you up. Just phone me up. Be careful how many drinks you have. Find a friend to go with who is sensible. All those kind of things that fathers tend to say to their daughters in those situations. That is what the Bible is doing with slavery. But the Bible does help us to go further than that. I've mentioned before that there's an interesting exhibit. It was in the museum in Oxford recently. It comes from the Smithsonian Museum of African American History. Displayed a rare copy of something called the Slave Bible from 1807. It's interesting. Missionaries really wanted these slaves. They'd been stolen, ripped from their families in Africa, brought to work in parts of America, and make money for people in the UK. And there were missionaries who said, we want them to know about Jesus. We want them to hear the Bible. We want them to hear the gospel. But the slave owners were worried about that. They didn't want their slaves to become Christians because that would put ideas in their head of freedom and of hope. So some of the slave owners said, okay, well, we'll let them have a Bible, but we want to edit it first. We want to take out the bits that might not be helpful to them. And I quote, they were worried that it might instill in slaves a dangerous hope for freedom and dreams of equality. So there are still a few copies of these edited Bibles available in museums. They had to take out actually most of the Old Testament and about half of the New Testament, because the more they read it, the more they realized how much of a problem the Bible is if you're trying to encourage the system of slavery. And you have to ask, if the Bible is pro-slavery, then why do they have to get rid of so much of it before they would allow slaves to read it? And it is because it is the central message of the Bible. Really, it's the heart of the Bible that challenges slavery. From the earliest times, Christians were thought of as weird because they didn't keep slaves. One of the first people to ever say that slavery is simply wrong and always wrong was a bishop in the early church, Gregory of Nyssa, said it to the emperor. People who've been involved in abolishing the slave trade practice, William Wilberforce, Martin Luther King, they were the kind of Christians who believe in taking the Bible at face value. They are not the kind of Christians that pick and choose which bits of the Bible are okay. Those kind of Christians found it very easy to just justify whatever was normal in society and carry on with it. But those who said, no, we really want to be based on the Bible, even if everybody else is angry with us for saying that, stood up and opposed slavery and racism. This is Adam B. Coleman. He's a popular journalist. writing for Newsweek and other US publications. He said this: many people who believe they're upholding the dignity of Africans by downgrading Christianity are actually doing the opposite, by trampling on the very worldview that so many of our ancestors relied on to propel them out of slavery towards freedom. When slavery was finally made illegal after the Civil War in the United States, somebody called Cy Henson, who had been a slave and escaped from it, he returned back south to his old home to meet his old slave master. His old slave master's wife was there in the house. It was a little bit overgrown. She was by now very elderly. She was struggling to see properly. She wasn't sure who it was. The only way she could recognize him in the end was by feeling the scars on his arms that were there from a time when he had saved his slave master's life, when he'd saved her husband's life. And when she realized it was him, she said, "Oh, Cy, Cy, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your master is dead and gone." But he replied, "No, madam, my master is yet alive." Because the central message of Christianity is that we have a new master. We have been set free from slavery. The price has been paid for that by Jesus, who died for us. And now we choose willingly and freely to follow a new master. And that is the message that has changed the world. And that is the message that drives away slavery.